All right. Good morning, listeners, and welcome to this week's News from the Drug War Front. My name is Jeff, and my co-host is Marianne. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, listener. How are we this morning?
A little bit chilly.
Oh, miserable day.
Yeah, a bit foggy.
Dreadful day. Very cold, very miserable to come into. Actually, it's not as cold. It looks like snow weather, but I always say that every time the clouds are like they are today, covering the sky, I always think it's snow weather.
Well, the really chilly mornings are the ones where you see the stars at night, isn't it?
Oh, yes, when you get a frost, that's generally when they're clear and you see the stars. And there's a big full moon last night.
Nice.
So it came right out as full. We've been watching it for the last, because the moon's been so big as it came up. Anyway, so awesome. Here we are, news from the drug war front.
Yeah, well, it's brought to you by CARMA, the Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimisation and Advocacy, which is Canberra's peer-based drug use organisation.
Canberra's only peer-based drug use organisation.
Right to pick me up on that, Maz. We're actually transitioning back to the office as of next week.
Great.
So I think
people will be able to come in. So that's on at the Churches Centre on Belconnen Way.
Yep.
Yes.
The office is the same as before. I think the guidelines state a maximum of 10 people in the office at any one time.
Right.
So we're staggering the staff over particular days and volunteers. And
okay.
Look, it's manageable.
But people will be able to come in and actually see you rather than communicate. Even though being able to contact you by phone was handy, you were still there, but at least now there'll be a place to come to, or again there'll be a place to come to. So yeah,
there's some things we're actually seeing somebody face to face.
Are you looking forward to that, Jeff? Are you looking forward to being back in the office, do you think?
Look, I think it's, there's some things that you can only really do when you're talking to somebody face to face, really.
Well, it's very difficult. I mean, without people's faces, you don't get a real sense of their attitude or their feelings, do you think?
I agree.
What we say, I could be frowning like crazy over the air now and nobody would know. I could have Lippy on and no one would know.
We could have our jammies on.
That's right. In fact, I've thought about that. I bought a new dressy gown the other day, so furry, and I thought, oh, I could wear that in. No, best not.
Well, that's actually been one of the positive things about the lockdown is you can wear your jammies at home.
That's right.
Comfortable.
Walk around anywhere, jammies on and a dressing gown and be happy, yep.
And we have actually, I think, done a pretty decent job of maintaining the services, you know, like the naloxone was still delivered.
Yeah, customers.
Yep. We've had the peer treatment support going, you know, Gabby and Monica.
Right. And how's the naloxone been going? You've been doing plenty of minimal intervention?
I think been plenty of business.
Yeah.
Dave and Dame have reported. So keeping the naloxone supplies getting out there, which I think is, you know, very important.
I'm pleased to hear that.
Good to hear. But a lot of stuff that's done online meetings like Zoom and WebEx, and, you know, I've learned a lot about other
More than you ever thought you would need to know.
Absolutely.
I imagine. Yeah.
And, like, you know, Zoom's not perfect, but you can set it up so you can see everyone's face. Meeting, we had 28 people.
As I say, face-to-face, you don't get the same thing, but if you can see people on Zoom or not using any other kind of, you know, interface over the interblog, then at least you get people's reactions. You can see how they're responding to what you're saying, and that's really important,
exactly.
I think, when you're trying to communicate fairly intense issues, because the stuff that CARMA does and the people that they interact with are really in a lot of difficult places sometimes, and you need to get a sense of how they feel about it. And what they say to you doesn't have quite the meaning that it has when you see their faces.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Especially with discrimination, with pain, with, you know, a lot of that is a lot of the a lot of what you know about people is how you see them. Pain is very much often a visual thing. You ask Gabby, when you look at somebody, when she looks at somebody, she says that person's in pain.
Yeah. Your face tells the story.
Very much so.
But as you say, Marianne, it'll be good to have the drop-in centre back open again as of next Monday, and the hours will be the normal business hours, 10 a.m. till 4 p.m. No appointment necessary. I mean, if you've got a complex issue, it might
pay. And that's Monday to Friday.
Monday to Friday, sorry.
Monday to Friday.
Yeah.
But, of course, the The phone's still available, 6253-3643. I'll say that again, 6253-3643. So for the rest of this week, Karma will still be operating, but over the phone, and then as of next Monday, which is, what's today, the 9th, so that'll be
the
9 and 6, what, 15th?
Yeah.
Is it?
What's that, the 9th?
16th. 9th today? 16th. Okay, from the 16th, it'll be from the Church's Centre, Level 1. What's the name, the room number, Jeffrey, do you remember?
I think it's 15 or something like that. But anyway, if you find the Church's Centre.
Up the stairs from Belcon and Way and around the back, and the Bob's your uncle.
You can't miss us. We've got all the signage out the front. And, but, yeah, no, it'll be a transition heading back, you know, just to see how the return to pre-COVID.
Well, and returning to pre-COVID, aren't we jumping back? Snap back, I think, is the expression they're into now.
I think caution.
Snap back, which means, okay, no more money. The 6 months' worth of 6 months' worth of free childcare, back to 2 months.
Really?
Yep.
The childcare as well?
They've decided the free childcare no longer going to be available.
That's unfair to women, especially.
It's very unfair to women. I suspect, because I'm a bit paranoid like that, and because I think they do women down in a big way, because of the lack of employment, they're using the jobs that women would have inaccessible. They're inaccessible because there won't be any childcare available because they'll have to pay for it.
I think that's just fundamentally unfair.
And, oh, well. Never mind. Well, at least we'll be able to see whether people have been subject, I guess, to domestic violence for a change, instead of hearing about it over the phone and feeling so powerless.
Yeah, because that's true.
That's one of the problems with phone connections, is that it's not a great, it's not an empowering thing.
Yeah, you can't give someone a hug and...
And that's often what they need. Often women just want someone to collapse on and weep on, but in privacy. With privacy.
No, I agree. I do have some positive news from the past week. I went to the protest last Friday.
Oh, did you? Good for you.
And it was way more people than I was anticipating.
I think there was way more people everywhere than anyone was
anticipating. Hasn't it been incredible?
It's fabulous. I am so impressed. And good on you, people of Canberra. Old farts like me that can't get out and get into it, but sit at home and are wishing and hoping that the meaning gets through, because we've had so much research, Jeff. We know so much about our Indigenous, brothers and sisters. We know... done more research than you can poke a stick at, but where's the action after that?
I mean, have the recommendations...
My niece typed up the results of the Black Deaths in Custody.
Yep.
Now, that was 30 years ago.
Have those recommendations been implemented?
When I was working in Trick, she was typing up... That was her job. She typed up the results of the research into Black Deaths in Custody. Now, we've known that for so long. What's changed? Not a damn thing, except that we have more black people in custody.
And that's one of the things that some of the speakers raised, was that, yes, we're marching in solidarity with what happened to George Floyd in Minneapolis, and that was just death on video. You watch somebody being murdered.
That's because we saw it, so we knew it happened, but we've known that's been happening. And in our heart of hearts, we cannot say we didn't know that.
No.
No one can say we didn't know that, because we've had more research on that. We've known that, prisons were no good for anybody anyway since... what was it, 1889, I think Tony Vincent said to me. We've known that since the end of the 19th century, which is the 1800s. And you just think, wow, we've known it for 120 years, 130 years, still got using the same buildings.
Yeah.
Still using the same buildings and the same genre, the same nature, the same attitude. makes me sick.
It was nice to see so many young people there, Marion. That was really heartwarming.
I'm really pleased you went. So tell me, what happened? How did you feel? Were you, I mean, apart from being 1.5 metres away from everybody else?
Well, look, it gathered in Garema Place and they handed out masks for everyone and they had the speakers. I mean, it was a shame the PA wasn't a bit, had a bit more oomph to it because some of the speakers were a bit, you know, distrained to hear what they were saying. Okay. But anyway, the atmosphere was good. And then we just walked down, you know, the main drag, Northbourne.
Down Northbourne.
Up the main road to Parliament. And
Really? You went over the bridge?
Over the bridge.
Great.
And the crowd seemed to swell, like the further we went.
That's fabulous.
I posted a couple of minutes of video during a No Justice, No Peace chant.
Yeah.
I was with Phil, one of our treasured volunteers, and also Damien. And Damien was very adept
at getting the chant going. I'm really proud of you for going. Yep.
Oh, look, there's nothing quite like being in the midst of a good protest.
Isn't it exciting, the feeling of being in it with people, like-minded people, yeah? Wonderful.
Yeah, it gave me a real buzz.
Yeah,
it was awesome.
Oh, best.
All right, look, we'll play a song and then we'll come back with some more of the show. This is PJ Harvey and the song is A Place Called Home, PJ Harvey. All right, that was PJ Harvey and A Place Called Home from her album Stories from the City, Stories from the Sea. And you're with Jeff and Marion in the 2XX studio, which of course is People Powered Radio.
That's right, public radio, how to get your voice heard. 2XX, join 2XX.
Yeah.
Become a member of 2XX if you want to get your voice out there and your opinion, because radio is an essential service and it reaches people that TV doesn't reach. It can get right out there to the public. If you want someone to know how you feel and how you think, get involved with public radio, because that's one way to have, it's a great medium for a point of view.
And there's over 60 original shows produced by volunteers at 2XX every week.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So that's a lot of good stuff that you're supporting
and
as a member.
Our show wouldn't be on any other radio station, any other medium. Public radio is the one show. And it's not because we say anything naughty, but with drug in the title,
there's just no room.
It kind of
in the mainstream media
freaks people out. Yeah. The mainstream media just wouldn't have it. Absolutely.
Yeah. No, well said. Okay, I'll just do the preamble about the Support Don't Punish campaign,
which is really important.
It is important. So, in order to participate in this year's Support Don't Punish campaign, which every year joins thousands of activists in taking action to call for an end to the global drug war, News from the Drug War Front and Karma are organising a writing competition for women who use drugs. We're collecting stories of women who use drugs and asking them for their suggestions how to improve the services and make them more gender sensitive and more responsive to women who do use drugs. So each Tuesday during the show until 29th of June, two winning stories will be read out by Marion and awarded with $30. The theme of the project is, quote, Stop the War on Women Who Use Drugs. Invest in harm reduction services that work for women.
Okay.
So the first story this week, Marion, is from Bella.
This is from Bella, and this is story one. Hi, I'm Bella, a sex worker, drug user and activist. I've been in this scene for a very long time. I've travelled all over Australia and witnessed the evolution of both drug user and sex worker activism. I've participated in protests, marches, conferences and community projects, worked with the community and tried to help especially young people finding their way in this cruel world that has a million and one ways to judge, discriminate, dehumanise and devaluate you, based only on a label they have assigned to you. This world that stops seeing you as a human being the same moment it learns that you use drugs or sex work or both is the same world that is actually full of individuals who use drugs, have sex, use the services of sex workers, have family members or friends who use drugs or sex or do sex work. That level of hypocrisy in the world we are living in is incomprehensible to me. I've facilitated numerous workshops with young people and sex workers, aiming to teach them how to resist all the negative messages they hear about themselves on a daily basis. How to fight stigma instead of internalising it. How to develop resilience and be self-confident. How to empower themselves and their communities. I can tell you now, although both sex work and drug use are still black labelled in this society, for me it was, and still is, much easier and less problematic to come out as a sex worker than as a drug user. I thought this might be the right moment to reflect on that, as it says a lot about me, but also the world around me. I'm not quite sure why it's easier to say I'm a sex worker than a drug user, and it makes me feel a bit guilty to begin with. Maybe I'm prouder of what I've done as a sex worker activist than what I've done as a drug user activist. Sex workers' rights movement is so strong and cohesive and achieved so much throughout history, from decriminalisation of sex work and better rights for sex workers to growing and connecting on an international global level. I'm not saying we've done it all. There's so much more to be achieved. But compared to the drug users movement, the achievements are really huge. Drug users are still fighting for drug law reform. Their communities are still gasping for air, riddled with poverty, poor health and overdose death, and still lacking serious leadership. They are still criminalised, not decriminalised or legalised. You see, I'm already talking from the perspective of someone who doesn't belong to that community. And I do. I am a drug user and I am passionate about drug users' rights in the same way I'm passionate about sex workers' rights. I don't know, maybe it's easier to speak from the role of a sex worker because for me, that's a much more empowering position. When you are a sex worker, you have more power and are more in control. You have the means to earn money and support the lifestyle of your choice. You have rights. As a drug user, you hardly have any rights. You give huge amounts of money to dealers for something you hope is the drug you have asked for. You're a customer in the black market, hoping for the best. When you try and find your way out to no one believes you, from your doctors and social workers to the police, politicians and the wider community. With the money you earn, you can rarely support your habit and lifestyle, and you're usually forced to do dodgy stuff that collide with your ethics and therefore damages your spirit and your whole being. Always worn out and anxious about the next hour, always worried about money and the law, always anticipating the withdrawal and debilitating state of mind and body brought about by lack of drugs. When you're a drug user, someone else is always in control of your life. Your dealer, police, parole officer, doctor, or doser at the methadone clinic. It's such a powerless position on so many levels. It makes me anxious and upset even thinking about it. I'm enjoying this moment of Black Lives Matter movement spreading all over the world. I'm not an Aboriginal, but I am not white either, and I've experienced a lot of discrimination because of my skin colour and ethnic community I come from. As I see and hear the slogan Black Lives Matter travelling around the world, I ache to see and hear people shouting, "Drug users' lives matter," in the same way, because in this society, in this world, lives of drug users don't matter at all. And it shouldn't be like that. What kind of world and what kind of society is this when we have to come out onto the street and shout that our lives matter too? How insane is that? Having to protest defending the fact that we are people too, and we do not deserve to be killed, discriminated against, disenfranchised, humiliated, .. So, giving the answer to your question how to improve services is not easy or simple, because your question is hard and complex too. How to improve services for female drug users in the world that is misogynist and so condemning about drug use? How to make friendly and non-judgmental service in an extremely hostile and judgmental world? How to find an empathic workforce in a world where to be a successful manager or executive, you need to have the personality traits of a sociopath? How to have a career in social or welfare services when the only language this society understands is money? How do you help people in need when governments are constantly cutting funding to the services designed to help the most vulnerable groups? Social and welfare agencies, alcohol and other drug services, domestic violence services, refugee shelters. I reckon the first step is civil disobedience and activism. That's how needle and syringe programs started, for example. People illegally sharing clean injecting equipment with their communities from the streets, cars, homes, rooftops. That's the beginning of what later, in the 1980s, became an efficient official national drug strategy approach that has made Australia famous by its successful dealing with the HIV epidemic, saving millions of lives and saving billions of dollars. Yes, it started as an illegal activity, as civil disobedience and as a social rights movement. And who had the main role in that? Who fought the retrograde conservative system and made the change possible? Peers. So I guess my answer would be, include peers in every aspect of service dealing with vulnerable and disadvantaged groups. People listen and trust peers. Invest in the training of community members who will be passionate about helping their peers, who will be happy to reach out to people and help them. That's the formula that has always succeeded, as history has shown so far. But don't wait for a crisis like with AIDS and like so many times before. Don't reach for peers only when nothing else you've tried has worked. Use the strengths of the community members before the crisis comes. Make use of lived and living experience. Make it part of the system. Use the knowledge and expertise of our communities wherever you can, whenever you can. Invest in harm reduction, peer service, peer-based services, and invest in opening positions for peer workers and consumer representatives in all services that deal with vulnerable groups.
That's one of the most powerful ones
that's
we've had.
That's a great story, yeah. And it is so true, too. That sounds like a long-time user, someone who's been around since the days of HIV and of the civil disobedience of handing out needles and syringes.
Yep.
So, yeah, great.
Especially
stuff.
Was resonated for me when she reads or says, as I see and hear the slogan, Black Lives Matter, travelling around the world, I ache to see and hear people shouting, drug users' lives matter in the same way, because in this society, in this world, the lives of drug users don't matter at all.
Absolutely. It's very potent stuff, yeah. And it's so intriguing, Jeff, isn't it, that even as peers, because I'm not in a treatment program, there are lots of places that I can talk about, right, with impunity, because it's not going to blow back on me personally. Yeah,
you're not worried about somebody.
Because service providers aren't doing anything for me at the moment because I'm not requiring anything of them.
Yep.
But there are people who cannot make complaints about services because they are consumers of those services.
And they're still vulnerable.
Like people on the methadone program or on the buprenorphine program, on opioid replacement therapies. Because they are using those programs, they find it difficult to be critical of the programs themselves, because they may well want that service to give them takeaways or let them go away for a holiday, and need to know in advance that they can do that. But if they criticise the program in a meeting, are they going to get their takeaways?
Well, people feel exposed and
they're
vulnerable.
Threatened.
Yeah, that's the
very
word.
Threatened by it. No, it's a really good story and very, very true. There are some areas in which the sex workers... I went to the first sex workers and the AIDS debate conference in Australia. It was in Melbourne. And it was really intriguing, and Julie Bates put together the conference, and it was really potent, and I was meant to be in charge of the sex workers and drug use, but there was a certain amount of nervousness about saying that sex workers and drug use go together. And in fact, Julie said to me in the first paragraph, we need to say the prevalence of drug use among sex workers is the same as it is in the wider community. So it was almost as if fear of saying that people use sex work to get money because it's the only way you can get enough money legally to earn, to support your habit, you have to actually pull back from that a little bit and say the prevalence of drug use in among sex workers is neither greater nor less than anywhere else in the community. So it was a really, even there we were saying, But don't say that sex workers are drug users because they aren't. Well, and it's true, they aren't all drug users. But it was really important for the purposes of the report that we were writing that that was what we said in that report. And I personally felt a little bit affronted by it, not simply because we had to feel guilty about being drug users.
Yep.
Not that I was a sex worker, I was there kind of as a drug user, not as a sex worker. But I don't know, who isn't a sex worker in a lot of ways? I mean, people, I reckon married women are sex workers too.
I've read books on that subject, yeah. Definitely.
And many men could be considered, you know, sex workers simply because they exchange sex for, you know, where they live and their meals.
Absolutely.
Do you know what I mean?
I do.
Sex work is not necessarily just money for sex.
No.
It's kind of in kind exchange, if you like.
It's more complex than the Mills and Boone romance stories.
Than that. Yeah, but
you said in your story about the what Julie Bates and the sex workers were nervous about, saying.
We can't be honest. It shouts it out loud, and I know so many people who cannot be honest about it, not to their families.
Yeah.
Their families don't want to know that they're using drugs, so they can't be honest. And whenever you can't be honest, you're lying. So, you know, basically, don't ask the question. Don't ask me if I'm using drugs if you don't want to hear me say yes.
And it's one of the many ironies, Marion, that people often in mainstream media portray drug users as inherently dishonest and liars.
Yeah. Well, and that they are other.
Yeah.
Too.
Yep.
Yeah. Sex work, I mean, drug users are other.
Yep.
Not us.
Yep.
Not you, not me, not, you know, they're not us. Yes, you're so right. They're portrayed as a whole, they're a community of people that don't look anything like us. And that's really strange because that's me.
Yeah, it's a political tool, isn't it, as well?
It is.
To have another, you know, to blame problems on or...
Well, I mean, and the reason that we got the National Drug and Alcohol Campaign, NACADA, and the HIV campaign was because Bob Hawke came to power and his daughter, Roslyn, was a drug user, had a reputation up and down. You know, I mean, we still bring this out because it is still one of those high-profile drug-using personalities that can be shown to be a reason for the implementation of programs.
It's a social policy that affects everyone in society.
And yet, because she was out, and, you know, I mean, there wasn't any choice about it, and really moved Bob to show that she was out, made him cry on television.
Yeah, on TV, which is, yeah.
But, and Hazel hated the drug, hated needle exchange, wanted needle exchange to be demolished, and I just, whoa, what's wrong?
Where
are you? What are you thinking,
Hazel? It's confronting for so many people, Marion. It's difficult.
And it's the drug they hate. That's what blows me out, and yet it's the individual that chooses to use the drug. And it makes them feel better. That's why they use the drug.
Yeah, there's so much dishonesty.
Get a grip. What's wrong with that?
Yeah. Look, yeah. I think things would be a lot better if we get rid of prohibition and, you know, virtually all those problems disappear in a heartbeat. But
well, that legal stuff, I mean, you can say you're a sex worker now because legally you're allowed to be a sex worker.
Yeah. And how much safer has it become? How much more, yep. you know?
Yeah. I mean, I can say now that I have, you know, that I had two plants at home and now I've harvested them, you know, and pulled them up because I'm allowed to do that. But prior to January of this year, I wasn't allowed to no. do that, even though it was a matter of who enforced what
well,
drug policy, what drug laws.
Yep.
It was actually, you know, discretionary, really, the enforcement of those laws. But other laws like ice and opioids and, you know, GMH or GBH, you know, you name it, the range of drugs that are against the law. And drugs that aren't against the law because you change one of their a little molecule or a chemical, you know, yep. construction of the drug, not against the law anymore.
A new drug, yeah.
Silly. Yeah.
Complex issues, but an excellent letter from Bella. Thank you so much.
Very good story. Yeah, well done. She earned her $30 there,
she
hey?
She did. No, a very, very thought-provoking letter. Thank you, Bella. All right, I thought I'd play a Johnny Winter song called Lay Down Your Sorrows. It's sort of somebody giving solace to someone.
Johnny Winter, wow. Wasn't he with the Albano?
Yeah, I saw him play once.
Yeah.
And Papa Wynn would have blown him over.
Was his brother?
Edgar.
Yeah, they're both guitarists and both bright, almost albino in
almost
looks,
translucent
yeah.
skin. Yeah. But this is from the John Dawson Winter 3 album, and it's called Lay Down Your Sorrows, Johnny Winter. All right, that was Johnny Winter from the John Dawson Winter 3 album and Lay Down Your Sorrows. Always been a personal favourite of mine, Johnny Winter. Great blues guitarist.
Oh, yeah, and fabulous looking. He's just so stunning, you know, just that bright blonde hair and bright pale face. And
pink eyes.
Pink eyes, yeah.
Yep.
Would be worth a fortune if he went to Africa, wouldn't he?
That was shocking, that doco I saw about.
Dreadful, very frightening.
Hunted for body parts.
That's just shocking.
Spiritual stuff.
No, I just wanted to let people know, because I hadn't said anything about it yet, that I'll be leaving early today, just 15 minutes early, because unfortunately I'm going to a funeral for Wayne, a long-time user and a friend of mine. We've known that Wayne's been ill for a long time. And
did he have cancer, Mary?
He had cancer, yeah, and he was. But I don't think he died uncomfortably. He was at home. He came out of palliative care, and eventually ended up at home in his flat with his family, or with his family around him. But I think he just went to sleep. But it was, you know, full of the drugs he liked and he was comfortable and I think he just went to sleep.
So a peaceful passing.
It wasn't like a painful heart attack or anything.
Yeah, he passed with
and
loved
so,
ones.
Yeah, I think he was at least in a comfortable position. And you know, I've known Wayne for a long time. When I came out of jail, he was the one person that I could speak to. And I try to avoid funerals where I can because the sorrow of it. But as I get older, there are going to be more and more around.
So we were saying that off air, weren't we?
Yeah.
All too
so
often.
I just want people to know that I'm going to say goodbye to Wayne. And because I owe it to him, because he was so good to me and such a support to me, even though I wasn't allowed to go and see him. My parole officer said, don't go and talk to him, but I did.
Well, you know who your
friends
are.
Because he was the only person. Well, I didn't know anybody else that I could talk to about coming out of jail. And he would he let me blurb on, which was what I needed to do and to get over the guilt.
Yeah. Well, that's a good friend. Look, I remember the only time I first came to realise that he'd actually even been in jail was when I saw The Australian Story, because, of course, I grew up in Melbourne.
Yeah.
I'm a recent arrival to Canberra.
Yes. Speaking of awards that we don't have.
And I watched it and I thought, oh, my God, and they took away our Order of Australia? Like, what's that all about? That seems ridiculous.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder if Tony Abbott is ever looking forward to being an ex-OAM, you know? Because there are very few of us. It's a clever club of people who are ex-Order of Australias or Companion of the Order of Australia.
Well, it just struck me as particularly unfair and probably more motivated by, you know, discrimination of drug users, because it didn't invalidated the work.
Absolutely had nothing to do with what I did. It was all to do with having broken the law and having gone to jail, and in which case I brought the order into disrepute.
Is that what they said?
That was their excuse. That was what they said. We just sent me a letter saying, this is it. You've brought the order into disrepute, and under section bleh of the law under which this is established,
we're taking it back. Wow.
Thank you very much.
All right. Look, we'll move on to story number two, which is from Jackie. Yeah. Yes, I'll hand over to you.
Okie-dokie, I shall go to this one. My name is Jackie, and I want the world to try and understand my story and wonder if this resonates with women and the experiences and challenges I have faced at the hands of many departments and agencies. I'm a mother with two small children. I made some terrible choices in my life, got myself into relationships that were initially loving, but as times went by, they became increasingly violent. I loved the father of my children so much that I hid the bruises and scars and broken bones and made up stories when the authorities interviewed me. I was too scared to speak up, as my partner throughout my entire 10-year relationship stated he will expose me to the authorities and that my children would be removed. My crime was that I used drugs. But I didn't use every day. I could manage to look after my children. Their food was in the house always. I cooked and cleaned and looked after them. I always walked them to school. They always did their homework. They were always neatly dressed for school. They were like any other children. I was so fearful of my partner telling people I used drugs that I continued to put up with the violence. It got to the point that a neighbour reported the fights to the police. They came out and charged my partner with assault. It was completely taken out of my hands. Then the dramas began when DVCS were notified. I met with them and I trusted them and spoke about the years of living in violence. I told them I always protected my children. They were never hurt. I loved my children and would do everything in my power to protect them. I opened my heart to DVCS because I thought I could trust them. That's Domestic Violence Crisis Service, by the way. This was my biggest mistake. The next thing I knew was that CYPS was at my door asking questions and telling me that if I did not take orders out on my ex, that my children would be removed. I felt so scared. I had no one to talk to. So I did what I was told and went to court to get an apprehended violence order, an AVO. This resulted in more pain and suffering because my ex, when he was interviewed, made up so many lies about my drug use, and again, CYPS have advised me they would be seeking drug screening as a requirement to keep my children in my care. I again was terrified that they would remove my children because of my drug use. I knew I could not fight or tell CYPS that I did not agree with this because I was so battered and downtrodden and I couldn't fight any longer. I admit that I did use a small amount of drugs, but I had it under control. This was not good enough for CYPS and they took over everything in my life and I couldn't get away from them. Over the next period, I tried not to use drugs. I did everything they asked of me, but I also had a few lapses where I used, which they couldn't and didn't understand. I was doing all the right things, but they continued to put more demands on me. I couldn't keep up with their demands, and finally I gave up. At that point, my ex was given the children, and I then felt I had nothing left to fight for. I tried to work on myself but went into major depression. I listened to the experts but found they all worked together and worked against me because they saw me as a drug user who would never change. I struggle now with trusting people. Well, what a surprise that would be, Jeff. I hope to one day get my children back. Oh, I'm not in a good headspace, but maybe one day I may get there. I guess my main question and source of my pain is the fact that according to what happened to me, this society and professional services believes that kids are safer to live with a violent and abusive father than with a mother who is a good mother but also a drug user. In this society, the violence and aggression are more tolerable and acceptable than drug use. I think that says it all about our society and culture. The only place where I felt listened to, understood and supported was peer-based organisations. Talking to people who have same lived experience that I have, not only drug use, but also experiences of stigma, discrimination and injustice that goes with it, makes me feel safe and not judged. It feels like they are here for me and have my back. So my recommendation to improve services for people who use drugs, employ peer workers. Talking to someone who has been through the same or similar experiences to mine makes a huge difference. It makes me less ashamed, less afraid, less defensive, and more trusting and hopeful.
Well, that was Jackie's comment. I think that what she says about employ more peer workers
It's an echo, isn't it, yeah. Jeffrey? Haven't we heard that echo? That's what Bella said.
Yeah.
Every week, the same thing. Drug use equals bad parenting. Drug use equals bad woman.
Yeah.
Drug use equals bad something. You know, it's
another
it's
thing
just
she
wrong.
Said that jumped out at me, just from my experience of seeing people, especially where partners were both using. You know, and the bloke would send the woman out to do the sex work
absolutely.
To pay for it.
Do the work, yeah. And she was working and he was building her up.
And a lot of, male partner violence, whether implied or actual, and, you know, just sort of...
And it's okay to be violent, but it's not okay to use drugs occasionally. That no matter what, you know, was there a report from the school? Were the kids turning up all the time? Were they doing their homework? Did they look okay? Did they have lunch? Was everything okay?
Surely that's the key criteria. Yeah.
Why were they not asking for other evidence or people from other places? And fancy, I'm really distressed that DVCS, Domestic Violence Crisis Service, gave evidence against this, that the children were at risk because the woman used drugs.
Yeah.
Not because of the violence of the male partner, but because the woman used drugs, because mum used drugs occasionally.
A lot of it comes down to the criteria of what is assessed as being harmful behaviour.
Is there?
Well, it's not always.
What's the criteria for being a good parent? I'd love to see what the list says. Okay, good parents look like what?
I don't think I've ever read anything like that.
Never
seen a...
And they
definition.
Talk about, the thing about agencies is that they are obligated to inform
mandatory reporting
of children at risk of damage, not having been damaged, but at risk of harm. And the fact that a woman uses drugs means they're at risk of harm.
Yeah.
Yet I know children who have been harmed, not by somebody who uses illicit drugs.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. There's all sorts of ways.
By somebody who uses perhaps alcohol.
Yeah.
Or perhaps just somebody who's a rat.
Yeah. Some
just
people
a
just
violent sort.
Dishing out violence and...
Absolutely. And yet, you know, an AVO is taken out and who gets blamed? The person who takes the AVO out.
Yeah. This is where the 5+ decades of prohibition is going to be so hard to undo.
I'm trying to unwind that stuff's incredible.
And the internalised stuff that people have, that they deserve to be treated.
That's right. And we believe it ourselves.
Yeah.
We have internalised it. So this kind of... believing it, why friends of mine will not tell their children that they're using is because their children are scared. Like when kids were learning not to smoke, right? They went to school and they came home and told their parents they were going to die because they smoked cigarettes.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want you to die, Mummy. I don't want you to die, Daddy, because you're smoking cigarettes. Well, the kids are internalizing that. Maybe it means they won't smoke, but why should they come home and tell their parents that they're going to die, live in fear that their parents are going to die, even if it might be 50 years down the track?
It's still scaring the
because
the kids.
They're smoking cigarettes.
It's a really...
And the same attitude now about tobacco as about illicit drugs.
Well,
really,
tobacco smokers are made to feel like pariahs, aren't they, really? I mean,
And cigarette smokers who don't use illicit drugs now understand what it feels like to be an illicit drug user.
Mm.
Yeah?
Yep. I'll play a little whimsical song. This is Ry Cooder, and it's post the global financial crisis, and it's called No Banker Left Behind. It's quite a whimsical little song.
Excellent.
Ry Cooder. Sorry, accidentally hit the wrong button and came back on air quicker
than me. Came back too fast.
got rid of Ry Cooder. But what Pretenders song did you want to hear, Marion?
Stop Your Sobbing, the first one, track one.
I brought that in especially for you because I know how much you love.
Yeah, I love Chrissy Hynde. I love the Pretenders. They're just fabulous. I read Chrissy Hynde and I keep quoting it to you. I know it must drive you crazy, Jeff, but I keep quoting Chrissy Hynde a lot, although she glossed over a lot of her misbehaviour. She didn't put out her memoirs until after her parents had died, which just shows you how much she adored them. But she dedicated the book, it was called Reckless, to her children. She had two little girls. I don't know who the father was. I just wondered whether, because I know she tried to get married several times in Liverpool when she was in England because she wanted to be able to work in England and not be sent back to the United States. But, yeah, she's an intriguing character.
She was in Rock when it was
She was involved in rock and roll, just going to concerts when she was 13, 14, 15. Like jumping in a car because I can drive at 16 in the States.
Yep.
Jumping in a car and going down to Texas because she was a Midwestern girl. But they knew, you know, rock music. And her favourite performer was Iggy Pop. And so she adored him. Just adored. And used to go to concerts and just touch his foot, touch his sandals. And, you know, all the bands that she adored are bands that I grew up with adoring as well. So, yeah, I appreciate it.
Well, this is from her
band. Stop Your Sobbing.
The Pretenders. Stop Your Sobbing.
Yep.
All right.
Chrissy, yeah?
Chrissy Hynde, yeah, I remember that song. And the Pretenders were a really influential band.
Absolutely. I mean, Chrissy Hynde, she used, and the Pretenders were actually an avenue through which many people came, played, and went on to other bands. She was... And because Chrissy never wanted to be the leader of the band,
she got
very offended when any of the photos of the band showed her only. She wanted to be part of a group, and that was important, which is unusual. It just shows you
how much women
were not front pieces, if you like, unless they had a manager of their own who promoted them by themselves, not for the whole band.
No, she forged her way by sheer hard work and talent.
Oh, absolutely, and was into music from, I think, the age of 14 on.
Yeah. No.
I just will read before, Jeffrey, I've got to
You've got to head
go
off for the funeral.
In about 15 minutes. Yeah. So I'll just, before I go, I want to read out the introduction that to this competition, the Stop the War on Women Who Use Drugs, Invest in Harm Reduction Services That Work for Women. In order to participate in Support Don't Punish campaign, which joins every June thousands of activists in taking action to call for an end to the global drug war, News from the Drug War Front and Karma are organising a writing competition for women who use drugs. We are collecting stories of women who use drugs and asking them for their suggestions on how to improve the services and make them more gender sensitive and responsive to women who use drugs. Each Tuesday until June the 29th, two winning stories will be read and awarded $30. The theme is stop the war on women who use drugs, invest in harm reduction services that work for women. Now, if you want to get in touch with the coordinator of this program, you can ring Karma on 6253-3643 and ask for Natasha, who is actually coordinating this particular project. Any of the workers at Karma can tell you about it, but Natasha can help you to write it. If you have problems with writing or with reading, just do that. Get in touch with Natasha. She will help you. We can print it out for you. We can write it down for you. We can put it on a text. It doesn't matter, but just get in touch. $30 to anybody whose story is selected and read out over the air. 30 bucks is no mean feat for just sitting down and writing what you is your experience. We want to know how you have lived your life as a drug user and why you haven't been able to get in touch with services. If you have been able to get in touch with services that worked for you.
We want to hear about it.
We want to hear about it. I'd love to know if there are people who have found services that work for them as women. So just get in touch with Natasha, 6253-3643 at Karma. And if you can't talk to Natasha, one of the other workers will tell you and get in touch with her for you and we can get back to you. So, you know, just ring us up, come in when the offices open next week or give us a phone call. We want to hear from you. We want to know your story and it's all your experience. You don't have to make things up because your reality is real.
That's
we
right.
believe in you.
Yeah. And we want
we
your
story.
We
believe your story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as Marion has said, there's staff members that can help if you just want to tell the story orally.
That's right.
Have somebody else.
Oral history is very potent too. Somebody will write it down for you. Just because you don't write it down doesn't mean if we pick the story out that you don't get the $30. You still get the 30 bucks. Don't think that we don't want to hear it because your experience belongs to you. We're paying you for your experience, not for your capacity to write, not for your capacity to be articulate or to spell or to print. It's for you to tell us about your life.
Your personal story.
You're the one that knows about your life and we want to write it down and read it out so that people will understand they're not alone.
Look, I found the stories incredibly powerful and the
That's what we were saying last week, Jeffrey, weren't we?
Yes.
I was saying, Jeffrey's sitting here learning from me when I read out. He's learning the stories, learning about women's lives himself. So, I mean, peer workers are women as much as they are drug users. Jeffrey is a peer in as much as he's a drug user, but isn't a woman, so he doesn't really know the experiences of women unless we tell him.
Yeah.
So please get in touch with Karma, please get in touch with Natasha or any of the workers and we will help you to write it down and then maybe you'll win your 30 bucks. But your life matters to us and your story is your own story.
Yeah.
It belongs to you, the fact that you give it, read it, say it to somebody else doesn't stop it from being your story. The fact that we pay you $30 to write it down and read it out doesn't mean that you lose control of the story.
No,
okay?
It's their story.
It is still your intellectual property.
Yep.
It's still your life we're talking about. So please get in touch with the project manager and we'd love to hear from you. I'd love to read out. I'd love to have so many stories. We can't give up by the 29th because and so much is the same. Yeah. So many of the stories ring true every time
the
we read them out. They're
consistent.
Very similar.
Yeah. And the last point I'd add on that, Marion, is that if somebody knows a woman who's been a drug user and thinks that their story would be suitable for this, encourage them to call Karma.
Or if they won't do it themselves, ask if you can do it for them and get the $30 for them. I mean, really,
we want the stories.
We want the stories. We want to know why services aren't or are working for women.
Exactly.
And how we can make them work for women. By the sound of it, over the last 3 weeks, that's how many we've done, 6 stories, 3 weeks, we now know that peer workers are a really good way of getting services to be good for women, to work for women.
Yep.
So,
keep them
but
coming.
If there are more ways, yeah, keep them coming in. We want to hear that. Even if peer workers don't work for you, we want to hear that too. Yep. And why maybe they don't work for you. Yep. But let us know, because we want to know from you.
Exactly. All right, going back to the 60s again, this is an early Stone song. It's Little Red Rooster.
Little.
All right, that was the Rolling Stones and Little Red Rooster. It's coming up about 19 minutes to midday. We're in the home stretch of this week's news from the drug war front on Community Radio 2XX 98.3 FM. And I'd just like to mention that on next week's show, we're going to have a guest from the Alcohol and Drug Service, or ADS, so that should be well worth tuning in for. And I'd also like to just do a quick shout-out to my friend Andrew for taking the effort to get my printer up and running at home. Cheers. And also, yeah, just wish Wayne Schmidt a good send-off today at the funeral, which Marion is en route to as I speak. Okay, I thought I'd wrap up the show with a news story from the Saturday paper, which comes out every Saturday, obviously. This is the current issue, and this piece is entitled Double Lockdown by Mahmoud Fazal. And the subheading is, a visitation ban in New South Wales prisons during the coronavirus crisis has cut off a key entry point for drugs into these facilities. But with so many inmates struggling with opioid dependence, tensions are rising. Hefner is succinct in his description. The COVID situation in jail is just disgusting, he says. The 22-year-old, who was recently released from Silverwater Correctional Complex, says that since visits were suspended across New South Wales prisons on March the 16th to prevent the spread of the coronavirus, tensions had been high. They'd lock us up in at least 3 of 7 days, every week, 24-hour lockdowns, he says. Prisoners say that within weeks of the visitation ban, serious incidents broke out at Wellington, Cessnock and Goulburn prisons. Last week in Lithgow, 12 prisoners were injured in a brawl. In the Mid-North Coast Correctional Centre near Kempsey, a prison officer was held hostage for several hours. Quote, the protests have been going on because we're being told they're stopping visitations until the end of the year, says one prisoner currently on remand at the Macquarie Correctional Centre in Wellington near Dubbo. Quote, it's been very tense. There've been fights everywhere. One of the pods got burned down because they've been locking them in a lot. The visitation ban is part of a coordinated effort across Corrective Services New South Wales' 38 correctional facilities, which currently house some 14,000 inmates and employ 7,500 staff. While some countries have responded to the COVID-19 threat by releasing low-level offenders, Australia has instead tried to create, quote, bubbles inside its prisons. All staff and inmates are screened on entry to a prison to identify those with any symptoms of COVID-19, says a spokeswoman for Corrective Services New South Wales. We are following the expert advice from New South Wales Health and working closely with Justice Health and Forensic Mental Health Network. According to Corrective Services, new inmates are quarantined for 14 days and those who show symptoms of the virus are isolated. Prison transfers have been limited to urgent medical escorts and transporting inmates from court to prisons. But even as restrictions ease across New South Wales, its prisons remain in a state of lockdown. Quote, virtual visits offer those incarcerated a window into their family homes, but there are drawbacks. Yes, it's nice to see the kids running around and the dogs, says one prisoner from a maximum security facility, but the online visits are less than half the time of a visit in jail, only 20 minutes. All of this has built up to a red-hot situation, says the maximum security inmate. He blames the tension on overcrowding. There's boys on remand doing 3 outs in a 2-out cell. Blokes are sleeping on the floor. It's a shambles. But the visit ban has also highlighted the opioid crisis playing out in New South Wales prisons, stemming the flow of drugs into facilities across the state. Without any in-person visits, April recorded 135 incidents of intercepted contraband in mail intended for inmates, up from 22 each month on average last year. At John Moroney Correctional Complex in Windsor, officers found strips of the opioid buprenorphine concealed in the seam of a cardboard envelope with a fake return address. In Bathurst Correctional Centre, staff discovered 10 strips taped to a greeting card that read, "Love is in the air." Buprenorphine, sold in Australia as Subutex and Suboxone, is a prescription drug that is widely used as an alternative treatment to methadone for heroin or other opioid dependents. Cheap, effective and considered easy to smuggle, it has become one of the most ubiquitous drugs inside of New South Wales prisons. According to a Justice Health and Forensic Mental Health Network spokesperson, as of April the 30th this year, 1,236 adults in custody in New South Wales are receiving opioid substitution treatment, or OST. But prisoners estimate as many as 80% of inmates are using the drug. Quote, "There's a huge percentage of drug users in the prison system who depend on the drug to get through jail," says Hefner. "Some people simply can't cope in jail without the drug. It's a very lonely place and your mind is your worst enemy inside." The rise of opioids in Australia's prisons stretches back to the 1990s. Vu Pham spent 19 consecutive birthdays as an inmate in the New South Wales prison system. Quote, "I was first incarcerated in 1997, he says. "In those days, most people that came into the system simply had to go cold turkey." A former heroin user, he first experienced the methadone program in Silverwater. "They were trying to get as many people to sign on to the program as they could," he recalls. "They were handing it out like lollies." In the late 1990s, concern within prisons about the spread of blood-borne viral infections such as HIV and hepatitis C led to a rapid expansion in the number of correctional institutions offering opioid substitution therapies, or OST. Quote, "There was a lot of people who weren't using heroin who jumped on the program just to get a high," says Pham, who now works with youth in Cabramatta. "Man, we're in prison. What do? You're desperate to escape the reality of your situation." So everyone was like, "Yeah, why not?" 2 decades have passed and they're still on it because of that day. When Corrections New South Wales first introduced buprenorphine, it was in tablet form. Quote, "People were diverting it. They'd just put it on foil and smoke it," says Pham. "Then they changed it to the strips. But then they started to divert the strips too. They would lace their mouth with bread and when the nurse puts it on their tongue, they'd roll it up. Then they'd smoke it or shoot it." Inmates on the buprenorphine program are often pressured by others to divert their dose, and doing so can also be a financial boon. One strip of bup can be broken down into 10 hits, each sold for between $50 and $100 inside. There have been reports of recently released prisoners who are on the buprenorphine program breaching their parole to be able to continue selling inside. "There is a huge drug issue in the jails that no one really wants to talk about," says one current employee of Correction Services, who spoke to the Saturday paper on the condition of anonymity. "And it's because we're giving something out for free on the outside that's worth hundreds of dollars in the jails. One strip is worth $500, says Pham. "I knew someone that was getting 36 strips a week in jail. You do the math." Corrections New South Wales appears to be trying to address the buprenorphine problem in its prisons by introducing a new opioid substitution treatment. They're trying to get everyone to sign on to this new program. It's called Buvidal. Listeners to the show will know Buvidal is a preparation of buprenorphine that can be injected under the skin, and I think there are weekly and monthly doses that are available, so it's you can sort of see from the jail's point of view that it might suit their purposes better, given that it's a weekly or monthly injection. They're trying to get everyone on to sign on to the new program. It's called Buvidal, says the inmate currently on remand in Macquarie Correctional Centre. Quote, "We have to go back every month for an injection, so you just can't divert it." Previously, inmates were provided an under-the-tongue treatment in the form of a film, which was required daily, a Corrective Services New South Wales spokeswoman says. The new method releases the buprenorphine into the body more slowly, helping them feel more stable. Additionally, inmates cannot pressure other inmates for their dosage. As for the visitation ban, it seems that it will continue on for the foreseeable future, with Corrections New South Wales saying it is, quote, unsure when the ban will be lifted. In media reports, the reduction in drug flows into prisons has been spruiked as an uncomplicated win. But little has been said about the effects that this is having on prisoners, or how it's feeding into the growing tensions inside these facilities. One person incarcerated in a New South Wales maximum security prison says the situation is becoming dire as the visitation ban stretches on and on. Quote, "They're trying to get high any way that they can," he says. "I've seen a bloke get his methadone. He came back to the unit, took his rice cooker bowl into the shower, threw up his methadone and strained it through a sock for his mate to drink." Oh my Jesus, just the thought of that makes me feel ill. The unnamed Corrective Services New South Wales employee says tensions are feeding violence against prisoners on sanctioned OST programs, and he recalls a recent attack on one inmate. Quote, "When he got back to the yard, he was knocked to the ground. They stuck him with a syringe and tried to get it out of him," he says. That's how desperate people have become. So that's quite a shocking piece from the Saturday paper, which I recommend if anyone wants to support independent media that does still exist in Australia. The Saturday paper comes out every Saturday, and I think it's worth the list price of $4. And that was from this week's issue written by Mahmoud Fazal. Okay, go to a quick song, and this is Jimi Hendrix and The Wind Cries Mary. Jimi Hendrix. Yeah, of course, the magnificent Jimi Hendrix, and that was The Wind Cries Mary. Okay, we're just into the last 5 minutes of this week's news from the drug war front. I'd like to thank my co-presenter, Marion, for doing the show with me, and you can't say somebody go and enjoy a funeral, but I hope Wayne gets a good send-off. I only met him a few times, but he seemed a really lovely fellow, and it's just sad when one of our community passes on. Seems to happen a bit too often these days for my liking, but we shall return next week at the same time. News from the Drug War Front will be on at 10:30 a.m. next Tuesday, and we'll have a special guest from the Alcohol and Drug Service. I'm not sure who that guest will be, but I'm assured that we will have a special guest from ADS, the Alcohol and Drug Service, on next week's show. And just to expand on what Marion was saying about asking friends of yours if they would like to put their story down and have Marion read it on the show. We're really keen to get stories from women and the impact of prohibition on their lives and services that have been good, bad or indifferent, and any ideas for actually making services more responsive to women clients and women who have had past or present illicit drug use or even licit drug use. We want to keep hearing those stories, and you get paid $30 and Marion will read the story on the air. So, and in the meantime, remember that you can still call Karma. The number will get you through to a staff member, 6253 3643. And starting from next Monday, we will be transitioning back into the physical space in the church's centre in Belconnen. So we shall be returning to our headquarters starting from next Monday. But in the meantime, just call the number 6253 3643 if you need any assistance or advice from Karma. Okay, that takes us out from this week's show. Going to leave you with the theme song for our show, which is by The Stranglers, and it is, of course, Golden Brown. Take care, everyone. We shall be back next Tuesday. Bye for now.